science and technology in our lives. Then throw in some culture, history, ethics, philosophy, and religion. That's Spark Dialogue Podcast, where it all comes together. I'm Elizabeth Fernandez. Imagine you're having a bad day, a really bad day. In a moment, a household accident causes you to permanently lose your fingers on one of your hands. Suddenly, you know your life will never be the same again. But then imagine an outpouring of support from your local community. Support that makes you realize that something truly good can indeed come from tragedy. This is exactly the situation that Edie Steinhoff found herself in. After a household accident, her local university community came together to support her, going so far as to work on building her a new prosthetic hand. Today, we talk to Edie, as well as to Dr. David Groh of New Mexico Tech, who leads a team, along with two of his students, Becca Sappington and Chris Schmidl. We discuss prosthetics and how advances in 3D printing and machine learning are allowing artificial limbs to become increasingly advanced. But we also talk about what it feels like to do research that benefits someone who you can interact with on a regular basis, how more good is coming out of this process, and how love and a sense of community can truly drive science forward. Edie, let's start with you. I think it was about a year ago now that you had a really, what some people could call a really bad day. Could you tell us what happened?
It was the week before Thanksgiving, and I was remodeling my kitchen, and I was in a hurry, using the table saw, and in an instant, I lost all my fingers and thumb. And I wrapped a towel around it, and I got in my car, and I thought, I'm not going to be able to drive. So I went across the street to a neighbor, Gina Chavez. She also works at Tech. And she got her daughter to drive me to the hospital. And she went and picked up the fingers and put them on ice and brought them to the hospital. She was amazing. And she saved my life.
So they were able to reattach one of your fingers then at the hospital?
The local hospital sent me to the UNM Trauma Center. And there, Dr. Mercer reattached my second finger and thumb. But the thumb had to be re-amputated a week later. It didn't take. So I'm left with just the second finger.
Yeah, so I imagine this came as quite a shock to you. I mean, obviously, no one wants this to happen to them. How did you feel when you returned to work? You returned to work just a week later. What happened after you came back to Tech? What was the response of the community?
The community was amazing. I got emails, flowers, people praying for me. I mean, it was just like a great big family. It was amazing. And a donor anonymously donated to get this project started with mechanical engineering. And I couldn't have been in a better place for such an accident.
How did you hear about the accident that happened to Edie, David? Was it publicized in the campus news, or did you hear about it from word of mouth?
I was at home, and I got a call on my cell phone from one of our staff, Colleen, who told me that basically there'd been a horrible accident involving another staff member, and just wanted to inform me of what had happened and start a dialogue about what we could do within the New Mexico Tech community to assist. And, you know, my background in robotics has had a biomedical flavor almost from the beginning. And I've done a little bit of work relevant to prosthetics before, which is, I think, why Colleen reached out to me. And the whole thing kind of quickly started evolving from there.
Okay, so when you did hear about what happened to Edie, was this an immediate thing for you? You're like, yeah, let's rally together. Let's build her a prosthetic hand.
Well, you know, it did involve a redirect of attention. We have a lot of interesting robotics projects that we're working on now. And there's certainly no lack of interesting new projects to work on. So actually, my immediate concern was, you know, do I have the bandwidth to make this push?
Right.
And if there hadn't been this personal connection to one of our own, I think I wouldn't have picked up this project. I didn't know if frankly we had the time to do it. And I think one of the cool parts of this story is how quickly a team was formed of, you know, early on strictly volunteers who wanted to help in some way. So the bandwidth did develop as people were hearing about the story.
Yeah, and I think that's what makes your story so special and so unique is that you actually have a person in mind that you want to help, and that people were so excited to come together to help this person that it just sort of happened very organically.
Yeah, I'll just, for many of your listeners that have likely not been to New Mexico Tech in Socorro, New Mexico, we're a small town and rather isolated in many ways. And we attract some really bright students. And of course, many of our incoming engineering students begin with a lot of enthusiasm about robotics. So I never have a shortage of students who are both bright and interested in doing something in robotics. And I often have to turn them away. So early on, after hearing about Edie, I had an opportunity to take some of these students who were coming to my office and tell them the story. At the same time, I was teaching a graduate level course called biomedical mechatronics. So essentially the topic of the course was how can tools from the field of robotics be applied to biomedical engineering? So between the students that were just knocking on my door and some of the students in that class, which actually included some very ambitious undergraduate students, this team began to build.
So, Becca, let's go over to you. And so when you're looking at building a hand, obviously a hand is a very complex system. It can do a lot of really fine types of motor control. So when you start this process of thinking about how to put together a prosthetic hand, what are some of the biggest challenges that you have to address?
There's a lot of challenges with putting the hand together. Just there's a lot of things that go into considering how the prosthetic will look. And so we have a subgroup that's specified in designing the hand. And a lot of issues come from our printing capabilities. We have our 3D printer, which prints with PLA, which is polylactic acid. It prints very well, but certain models that we've come up with need support material. Our dual extruder will help give us support material.
You know, it's easy to underappreciate the complexity of the human hand. If you go from finger to finger and try and count up all the different ways the hand can move, you find that just between the fingers and the thumb, there are 20 degrees of freedom. And, you know, now you try to pack all of those joints, all of the motors or actuators that affect those, as well as the sensors that might record, you know, what the given position is of a joint, into the volume of the human hand. It is an incredibly difficult mechanical engineering problem that's also, you know, a difficult electrical engineering problem. And, you know, that doesn't even begin to get into how does the user end up connecting mechanically, you know, connecting from a control standpoint. And then there's the problem of, you know, manufacturability. Part of the goal is to really create as much technology as possible at a price point that makes sense for not only, you know, Edie, but this gives us an opportunity to affect a broader community of New Mexico. And so, you know, there's some very unique features to our population, relatively low income, dispersed, you know, 50% of the state lives in rural areas. And so, you know, how do you create something that's got all of the functionality you want, but come up with something that doesn't cost $200,000? And that's when you get into, okay, well, then we need to use, you know, open source formats. We need to use, modestly priced 3D printing technologies. And so some of these problems around printing that Becca is referring to are problems that you see when you're trying to do this in an affordable way.
How is 3D printing revolutionizing what we can do with prosthetics?
Well, 3D printing is allowing us to make cheaper prosthetics. And so people can print from their home if they have a 3D printer. And there's also 3D printers around at schools and libraries. So it's making it more accessible for other people. So I think that's a main thing. And prosthetics, they're very, very expensive. And so you have other companies out that are making cheaper prosthetics that have their all of their files online for others to use. They're all open source. And so I think we're going to end up doing that as well, just trying to make some files that can be modified for other people that are going to be cheaper in the long run.
Yeah, and I can see one benefit of having this be less expensive is that you can make it more customizable for whoever needs it. And one instance for a person who might need a very cheap customizable prosthetic is like for children, for instance, because with growing, they might need different sizes of prosthetics as they grow up. So I imagine that people like this would also benefit from what you're doing as well.
Yeah, let me jump in and just say that another happy coincidence of this project was that a woman who's a biomedical engineering professor at University of New Mexico, whom I've worked with in the past before, had just before Edie's accident started making a push herself on the subject of designing 3D printable prosthetic hands with children in mind. And, you know, I'm a father myself. I was in the urgent care with my son just yesterday and yet another bike crash. He's always breaking bones and bashing himself up. And I can imagine how many times he would have broken his prosthetic hand by now. So it's, you know, not only do you have to get it right the first time in an affordable way, and as you say, address a child who grows, but imagine, you know, the way they handle their backpack or their lunchbox. They're going to take the same care with their prosthetic hand, which is to say that, you know, the expectation value of its life is probably 3 months. So can we design these hands in a way that parts can be replaced? As you say, as they grow, that the hand can grow with them.
Yeah. And so, Chris, going to you now, we talked a little bit about the challenges of developing a hand. And a hand is a very complex thing. I mean, it could do a lot of things when you think about it, like flip an egg, eat, zip up a zipper. I mean, the types of motor control you need are really varied. And so how do you go from taking this prosthetic hand and actually making it so that it has these fine controls so that the person who's using it can use it in all these different ways?
So as Dr. Grail mentioned, the hand is far too complex to accurately replicate for a reasonable price. And to replicate all those degrees of freedom with actuators that we can fit in a hand is just sort of unreasonable. So what we do is essentially simplify that into the degrees of freedom that we need most in a hand. So we look at what grasp types are most common and most useful for a prosthetic user, and we try to create a hand that will replicate those grasp types to create something that's most usable for the least amount of money. And in doing this, there are several sensing methods that have been used in the past. The most sort of common method is using electromyography. In electromyography, we pick up electrical signals created by the muscles on the surface of the skin when a finger is flexed, for instance. And these electromyographical signals are fairly difficult to pick up and translate into motion of a hand. So what our team has been doing is looking at other options, such as force myography. And that's what we're currently focusing on. So in this technique, we strap a band around the forearm of the user, and we have force sensors around this band, which we can pick up the forces that the muscles in the forearm create on this band. And these forces can be translated into movement of the prosthetic. To do this, we use machine learning techniques, such as neural networks. And these techniques gather a bunch of data from the forearm and from the force sensors on the forearm and try to replicate that. So with machine learning, we're able to map the force produced by muscle activity to a certain grasp type that we want to replicate with our prosthetic hand.
And let me just add that Chris mentioned this need to simplify. Joints themselves aren't hard or expensive. It's the actuator and the sensor that comes along with it. So one of the exciting ways to think about simplifying is to look for synergies in the way the hand moves. So if you think about your pinky finger, how often do you need to just flex one of the joints? The pinky moves together. So can we use a single actuator, a single sensor, to control the pinky entirely? If so, that could result in a much simpler control scheme and greatly reduce the cost.
And I wonder how many of our listeners have just tried to flex their pinky finger trying to make just one joint move. Yeah. So yeah, when thinking about how the prosthetic hand moves, it seems like sort of magic to me to go from motions on the skin. Is that correct? Or is it the muscles as well, that your brain is telling the skin and the muscles to move in certain ways, and then you can pick up on that, you know, you mentioned through machine learning, and figure out what kind of motions that corresponds to? How do you even begin to figure that out? What tiny little twitch of the skin or tiny little twitch of the muscle corresponds to what kind of movement?
Prosthetics researchers have really taken a multi-pronged approach. Is the right thing to do to find those signals in the motor cortex? Do you put electrodes in the brain to record those things? That's been done in human and non-human primates. Do you try and grab that signal as it makes its way from the brain to the muscle? Do you try and grab that signal, you know, as soon as that the muscle begins to contract and you can pick up that signal in the form of the electromyographic reading? Or this idea of force myography goes even a step further in that it's really inferring what's happening because you're mechanically measuring the way the muscle moves under the skin in response to that whole neural connection. So, of course, as you try and go upstream and tap into that signal back towards its origination from the brain, you tend to move into more and more invasive approaches. So the advantage potentially of this force myography is that while you are forced to infer a lot, you can do it in a non-invasive way. And early results that we've had in playing with this idea, which is also being pursued elsewhere, is that it may indeed provide sufficient information about the intention of the user.
Yeah, and I want to add that we don't need to pick up every small little twitch of a muscle to create a functional prosthetic. We need to pick up the movement of muscles that create useful grasps for the user. And those are a lot easier to pick up with these sort of techniques than every small little movement that a user could possibly try to make.
Okay, for Edie. So how are you involved with this process? Are you there helping them test out the various different types of hands?
At this point, I'm not deeply involved. I have met with them. I've tried out 4 different prosthetic hands.
So I guess you don't have a finalized hand yet that you're working with. This is sort of an ongoing work in progress?
Right. They have several groups working in different directions, and okay. When they finalize their project, then I get to go and try them all out and see which works best for me.
And okay. Let me just chime in and say that it's, you know, great to have someone like Edie who can be involved not only at that end stage, but the hardware that Edie has tried out and provided feedback on are very early prototypes. And that's been so useful to, you know, as we explore all these different potential methods of accomplishing something, that we've been able to present those to Edie and get that early feedback, which has really helped steer the engineering process.
Becca, looking at these different types of hands, do they look like a realistic hand?
Right now we're working towards making it look more realistic. We're looking for different programs that we can use to make our hand look a little bit better. There are different ideas of what a pretty hand will look like to so many different people. So that's kind of what we're working towards, is just finding something that we both like and that would be presentable to Edie. And so she has some different ideas. She wants a very pretty looking hand. But yeah, right now they think they look very human-like, but we can make them better.
Okay. And Chris, how do you think this is different than other prosthetics that are on the market right now?
Well, we're trying to fill sort of this middle ground that exists on the market right now between purely mechanically actuated prosthetics at the low end and really highly invasive but sophisticated prosthetics at the high end. So we're looking for alternative ways to control this that are more intuitive for the user, that aren't as complicated to control, but that still provide a high level of functionality. And studies have shown that currently the more advanced a prosthetic is, the more it's actually likely to be abandoned, because as the prosthetics become more advanced, they become harder to control, and the usability or the usefulness of the prosthetic doesn't increase that drastically with the increase in the difficulty to control them. So we're trying to fight this and create a prosthetic that is highly functional, but also very easy to control.
Okay. And for both Becca and Chris, I think this is a really great project for undergraduates to be involved in. And like David mentioned earlier, this is a really interdisciplinary project. I mean, not only are you learning about robotics, but you're also having aspects of machine learning come in, and you have to learn about the muscular system of the body. So how does it feel like to be part of a project like this? And do you think this will benefit you as you move forward in your careers?
Yeah, this is definitely beneficial. When I started out going into engineering, I started out into petroleum, and I decided, oh, that's not for me. Went into mechanical and decided I wanted to work with prosthetics. And then I met Dr. Groh, and I got onto this project. It's been difficult, honestly. I'm new to robotics, so this is really fun to start learning about it. And I've learned a lot with working with Dr. Groh, and I think it's going to be very beneficial for me.
Yeah, so I think this sort of project is really good for mechanical engineers, because it does give them experience in other engineering fields. And, you know, I was interested in robotics since high school. And coming into New Mexico Tech, I wasn't sure if I wanted to go into mechanical engineering or electrical engineering. And I chose mechanical engineering, but I still had an interest in electronics and programming, things like that. So, you know, this project is just a really natural sort of gateway to allow me to experience some electrical engineering and other things that I wouldn't be exposed to in other sort of mechanical engineering specific projects.
Edie, sometimes very good things can come from very bad things. And I think that you said before that you only wanted a small part of the funding to actually go to making a hand for you, and you wanted the majority of this funding to go to helping other people as well. Where does that motivation come from, and how do you feel about that in retrospect as to what happened to you?
Well, what happened to me was a shock, but I've overcome it pretty easily. There are some things that I really would like to do. Cutting meat is a challenge. Putting in a nail in the wall. Those things I really would like to get back. But as far as a sophisticated prosthetic, I don't need it. And I think that helping tech focusing on children would be a far better use of the money that's been raised.
Yeah, and I think that's a really great and selfless thing for you to do. So for the people on the team, you know, a lot of people work on these projects that help other people, but like I said before, you don't always know who you're helping. And so how does knowing who you're helping, how does that change how you feel about this project?
It really hits home a little bit, especially because she's someone here at Tech. I've come to, you know, really love being here. And so the fact that she's one of the people that works here, feels really good to help someone out.
Yeah, it's really great knowing her so that we can get her feedback and get her best interests in mind when we're designing this. And, you know, we're not just designing some prosthetic that we hope that some unknown person will be able to use and that they'll like and everything. We get to have this personal interaction with Edie and make sure that this is going to be something that's actually making a difference in somebody's life in the way that you want it to.
I'll add that engineers love to solve problems. And sometimes we solve problems that we don't need to solve. And it's easy to let a design project, a research project run away from you. And, you know, having Edie in the loop and able to say, no, I don't need that, but I do need this. Steering us back to the high priority things, keeping us on track has really made a difference here.
Yeah, and I think that's a very unique aspect of this process, to be able to work so closely with the people that you're helping.
I think one interesting point, something that might engage the imagination of your listeners, is that it could very well be the case that the best approach is not to make the does-everything prosthetic hand. It might be the case that, you know, the appropriate thing to do is to make multiple versions. A couple of the things we're thinking about, number one, we talked about, you know, with children in mind, the fact that they're growing, the fact that they're likely to break their prosthetic hand. Are there ways in which you can follow a modular design strategy? Maybe you take the sophisticated electronics, the actuators, and put them into a compartment that's tucked away, sort of protected from damage, and also compartmentalized in a way that if a larger hand is needed, that it can essentially reconnect to the expensive components that you've already purchased. So we're looking at modular design strategies with that in mind, but also potentially modular sort of in a utilitarian sense. You've got the hand that allows you to perform a pinch grasp. So when Edie's going to hang a painting on her wall, the pinch grasp is what she would use to hold the nail. You might have the evening, you know, the fancy dinner gown hand that is aesthetically correct. You mentioned earlier the sort of where are we in terms of the degree of realism in the prototypes we're building. In my mind, functionality and aesthetics really are different goals. And it's interesting to see how that plays out. A hand that is first and foremost aesthetic is referred to as a cosmesis. And cosmeses often are not functional at all. It's been interesting. Researchers have found that often it doesn't make sense to do both. The, you know, everyday hand that goes with you to, you know, washing the dishes and hauling out the trash, maybe that shouldn't be a cosmesis. There's something of an uncanny valley that occurs. You know, our human hand is constantly regrowing skin. We can, you know, eventually the paint from our weekend painting project is either washed away or that skin falls away and we have fresh skin that comes underneath. It's a very difficult problem when you're talking about an expensive cosmesis. What happens when it slowly stains over time or it gets the paint on it? So often prosthetics users will select more of a please give me multiple options approach. So that's something that we're looking at here too, with cost in mind in particular. What are ways that we can take more of a Rolodex approach to the problem that maximize utility while keeping costs down?
Yeah, and I think that this is a great point, because being able to work so closely with Edie, you get to know exactly what she needs and what she wants, rather than just sort of trying to solve every problem that's out there in prosthetics.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, well, thank you all of you for joining today on the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
This is Elizabeth Fernandez for Spark Dialogue Podcasts. Some of you may be wondering how you can get notified of new podcast episodes. Perhaps the easiest way to do this is to subscribe. through a podcasting app like Google Play, Stitcher, or iTunes. You can subscribe to Spark Dialogue, which is all one word, and set it to notify you when new podcast episodes are released. But if these apps aren't your thing, you can also like us on Facebook at facebook.com/sparkdialogue or on Twitter at sparkdialogue, where every new episode is posted along with other cool science and technology news. And links to do all of these are also on our website at sparkdialogue.com, where there are also show notes, ways to contact us, and how you can rate the show. As always, thanks for listening.